I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 3rd, and we have a lot to talk about. And we have to start by sharing some sad news, because last week, the MS community said goodbye to a true MS warrior, an activist, a tireless advocate, a supporter of people-powered research, a friend to this podcast, and just a special person who we were lucky to know. Karen Jackson passed away, ending her courageous battle with MS. I interviewed Karen 2 years ago on episode 61 of the podcast. It was a week before the 2018 midterm election, and we talked about things that you could do or prepare for to ensure that your polling place was fully accessible. By law, polling places are required to be accessible to people with physical disabilities, but as Karen explained, the law and the reality that you might face when you arrive at your polling place don't always align. It's ironic that we're talking about Karen's activism on behalf of disabled voters on a day when voters in the United States are casting their votes in what many consider to be the most important U.S. election in modern history. And as Karen would be quick to remind us, we're exactly 1 week away from the day when the Trump administration, along with 20 Republican state attorneys general, will appear before the Supreme Court and ask the court to invalidate the Affordable Care Act, eliminating all of the legal protections and putting access to health insurance at risk for people with pre-existing medical conditions. Karen would have plenty to say on this subject, and I hope that I've managed to adequately capture her thoughts over the past few weeks when we've talked about this subject on the podcast. But today is Election Day, so I hope that everyone listening in the United States has already voted. If you haven't, and the polls are still open, please hit pause right now and go vote. Karen would be the first one to remind you of where the priorities lie today for people living with MS and every other chronic condition. Karen Jackson was a force to be reckoned with and a true difference maker, and she'll be missed. Fatigue is considered to be the most common MS symptom and also one of the most disabling, because fatigue can interfere with every aspect of someone's life, at home, at work, in their relationships. In every way, fatigue can have a profound impact on your quality of life. Today, we're talking about how to best manage MS-related fatigue with my guests, Dr. Bardia Norbaksh and Dr. Kathy Zukowski. Dr. Norbaksh is an assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where his current research interest is focused on identifying new pathophysiologic mechanisms and therapeutic targets for multiple sclerosis-related fatigue. And Dr. Zukowski is a returning guest of the podcast. She's the senior director of patient management, care, and rehabilitation research at the National MS Society. And Dr. Zukowski brings to our conversation 25 years of MS clinical experience and 15 years spent investigating the mechanisms of underlying sensory motor impairments and disability resulting from damage to the central nervous system. But before we get to my conversation with Drs. Norbaksh and Zukowski, there are a few other things that you should know about. Stem cell treatments for multiple sclerosis is one of the top two or three subjects that I get lots of listener email about. And as interest has increased over the past couple of years, I've been a regular and outspoken critic of the shady, so-called stem cell clinics that for $10,000 or $15,000 promise near miracles for people living with everything from arthritis to erectile dysfunction to multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease. Many of these clinics have been proven to be unsafe, creating health risks rather than curing anything, and few of them offer anything close to legitimate stem cell therapy. At the same time, I've also pointed out that MS researchers are finding success with a stem cell treatment called autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT. And while AHSCT isn't equally successful for everyone living with MS, scientists are continuing to refine the patient profile for whom AHSCT might hold the most promise. Last week, the National MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee published their position on autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and I'll quote directly from their recommendation. The National Multiple Sclerosis Society believes that AHSCT may be a useful treatment option for people with relapsing multiple sclerosis who demonstrate substantial breakthrough disease activity, i.e. new inflammatory central nervous system lesions and/or clinical relapses, despite treatment with high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy, or have contraindications to high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies. The best candidates are likely people younger than 50 years with shorter durations of disease, less than 10 years. The procedure should only be performed at centers with substantial experience and expertise. Ideally, recipients of the procedure should be entered into a single database, and further research is needed to establish ideal cell mobilization and immune conditioning regimens. So there are some important details contained in this guidance that are worth emphasizing. First, AHSCT is being recommended as a useful treatment option for people with relapsing MS, for whom high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies have not proven to be effective. The best candidates for this procedure are people younger than 50 years old who have had MS for less than 10 years. And the MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee points out that this procedure should only be performed at centers with substantial expertise. These are not the stem cell clinics that claim to derive stem cells from your fat, spin them in a magic centrifuge, then reintroduce them into your system and send you on your way. That procedure isn't AHSCT, and that procedure doesn't work. If you're not getting this treatment at an academic medical center or major hospital, chances are pretty good that you're not getting AHSCT. With all its caveats, and actually because of its caveats, this recommendation from the National MS Society provides useful and important information to people living with MS who, up until now, have been met with an avalanche of misinformation and outright fraudulent information when they venture online in the hopes of gaining any real understanding of stem cell therapy as a potential treatment for MS. And we'll have more details to discuss about stem cell therapy to treat MS as this treatment continues to be further refined and researchers continue to learn more. If you'd like to review the National MS Society's published recommendation on autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, you'll find a link in today's show notes. November is National Family Caregivers Month, and with the passing of my wife Jean this past February, this will be the first November in over 20 years when I don't identify as a family caregiver. But 53 million Americans do identify as caregivers. That's one in five adults living in the United States. And of these 53 million caregivers, 89% of those caring for an adult are taking care of a relative. And over 21 million of those caregivers live with the person they care for full-time. When we talk about well-being and quality of life, caregivers are frequently overlooked and left out of that conversation. And overlooking the well-being of a caregiver, failing to provide the caregiver with the tools and resources so that they can care for the caregiver, can sometimes lead to unfortunate consequences for both the caregiver and the patient they're caring for. Those unfortunate consequences were highlighted in the results of a recent survey conducted by a research team from the University of California Riverside School of Medicine in collaboration with the North American Research Committee on Multiple Sclerosis. The study found that 40% or 4 in 10 people with advanced MS reported being emotionally abused by someone responsible for caring for them. 25% of the survey respondents reported being financially exploited. 1 in 6 reported being neglected. 1 in 9 reported being battered, and 1 in 12 reported being sexually assaulted by a caregiver. Overall, the research team found that 55% of the survey respondents disclosed undergoing some form of mistreatment since they started receiving care from a family member or friend. These survey results are more than alarming, and I'm hopeful that collectively we can do more than just talk about them. As someone who served as a caregiver for someone with advanced MS, I can tell you that it's a hard job. It's vastly different, more complicated, and more taxing than driving someone to and from a doctor's appointment. As someone with progressive MS experiences an increasing level of disability, their caregiver's to-do list continues to expand. At the same time, that family caregiver may be experiencing increased financial pressure, work-related challenges, social isolation, and depression that, left untreated, can lead to caregiver burnout. And when that happens, well, then we have two people in need of rescuing, the caregiver and the patient. This study at UC Riverside School of Medicine was led by Dr. Elizabeth Morrison Banks, who said, "The findings of this study represent a collective cry for help from so many families affected by multiple sclerosis across the United States." So, how will we answer that cry for help? Well, I'm hoping that a research project that I'm currently involved in will provide at least part of that answer. I'm part of an iConquerMS research team, and our team is in the midst of developing something called the Care Partner Protocol. Our project team is taking an evidence-based approach to identifying the most urgent priorities that MS caregivers face and then identifying best practices in addressing those priorities. The Care Partner Protocol will provide multiple pathways designed to proactively connect MS caregivers to support resources that can help reduce the stress, strain, and anxiety that caregivers can otherwise face. And hopefully, by mitigating some of that stress and anxiety, we can create better outcomes than those highlighted in this recent survey. You'll be hearing more updated information about the Care Partner Protocol as our work progresses. And if you'd like to review the University of California Riverside School of Medicine and North American Research Committee on Multiple Sclerosis survey results in greater detail, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Adults with MS and other neurological conditions are being recruited by the Birk Neurological Institute in New York to participate in a 12-week clinical trial designed to assess the health benefits of home-based, seated, tele-exercise. Research has shown that exercise delivers a variety of benefits to people living with MS. But getting to a gym or physical therapy facility can sometimes be challenging, even under the best of circumstances. And we all know that the COVID-19 pandemic has not provided us with the best of circumstances. In fact, it's introduced additional risks to worry about. Now, telemedicine is proving itself to be a major benefit to people living with MS, and this clinical trial is designed to determine whether tele-exercise might offer a similar benefit. To participate, patients must be medically stable, have no contraindications to exercise, be able to commit to the tele-exercise program, and be currently exercising up to 2 days a week. Participants must also have access to high-speed internet on a device with a webcam and be able to follow instructions in English. For more information on participating in this study, you can contact Amy Bialik, the research study coordinator at the Birk Neurological Institute, and you'll find Amy's phone and email contact information in today's show notes. Exercise has also been shown to be one way to manage MS-related fatigue. But managing fatigue can be a very tricky proposition. There's almost a sense of, well, there are things that can help, but we still have work to do here. In fact, as you'll hear from one of my guests, new research has shown that some of the popular medications that are most often prescribed to help with MS-related fatigue offer no more benefit than a sugar pill. In a moment, we'll meet my guests, Dr. Bardia Norbach and Dr. Kathy Zukowski. Fatigue affects about 80% of the people living with MS, making it the most common MS symptom. And many people agree that fatigue is one of their worst MS symptoms because it can interfere with their ability to function at home and at work. In fact, it's one of the primary causes of early departure from the workforce. But there are things that you can do to improve the way that you feel and minimize the impact of fatigue in your life. My guests today are Dr. Bardia Norbach and Dr. Kathy Zukowski. Dr. Norbach is an assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where his current research interest is focused on identifying new pathophysiologic mechanisms and therapeutic targets for multiple sclerosis-related fatigue. And Dr. Zukowski is a returning guest to the podcast. She's a senior director of patient management, care, and rehabilitation research at the National MS Society. And Dr. Zukowski brings to our conversation 25 years of MS clinical experience and 15 years spent investigating the mechanisms of underlying sensory motor impairments and disability resulting from damage to the central nervous system. Dr. Norbach, Dr. Zukowski, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Norbach, what can you tell us about what MS fatigue actually is? In other words, how is it different from non-MS fatigue and what causes it?
So fatigue is defined by a subjective lack of energy that is perceived by the individual or their caregiver, and it's severe enough to interfere with the daily activities. So what distinguishes fatigue from normal tiredness is perhaps its severity. In MS, fatigue is much more severe, is more pervasive. It is present most days, almost every day. And as we mentioned before, unlike normal fatigue, that is the result of activity. MS fatigue prevents the patient from doing or performing his or her activities. It's a very common symptom of MS, perhaps the most common symptom, and it's one of the most disabling symptoms of MS that we encounter in the clinic.
Dr. Zukowski, some of our listeners might be wondering why we're talking to a rehabilitation expert today when our topic is MS-related fatigue. So what are some rehabilitation strategies that people might use to improve their quality of life? And how are these rehabilitation strategies related to dealing with fatigue?
Rehabilitation is a really broad category, right? So the focus is really to optimize physical and cognitive function and quality of life, incorporating prevention, restoration, compensatory strategies, and maintenance approaches. So all of those things could be very helpful to someone with MS, with a condition that is so so variable and heterogeneous. And, you know, there are a lot of interventions that are possible to address fatigue. I think it's important to identify, you know, which one might work best for you. So if I just think of a few that are most supported by research, the first one that I would describe would be exercise. And with the kind of the policy that some exercise is better than nothing, the idea of kind of limiting overheating so you could explore the use of cooling garments. There are ways to reduce the energy costs of moving or walking by changing biomechanics. And even if exercise, you know, it seems so counterintuitive to suggest to someone who is suffering from fatigue to say, well, now go and put more effort into exercising, sounds really intimidating, I imagine. So I would suggest that there are ways to exercise differently. So one would be this idea of intermittent training. The idea is that you can maximize a greater volume of exercise if you just do a higher intensity of exercise for, say, 1 or 2 minutes, then you take a little break, and then you do it again for 1 or 2 minutes, and you do this for about 20 minutes. So I just encourage people to explore other ways to exercise, since we know that it really can affect fatigue. Cognitive behavioral therapy is another strategy that has science really backing it up. And the point of this is really to teach patients to recognize and change negative thinking. And this can really contribute to fatigue and disability. Controlling kind of what are called maladaptive thoughts, or this kind of excessive worry or catastrophizing. If you can identify what the triggers are for when you start to think that way, this could really affect, or this can really improve your fatigue. Other strategies that I think are really important to keep in mind would be self-management. So this is based on the idea that we can learn skills to help us monitor and tailor how we deal with fatigue in our life. And suggestions would be the way this process would work is that you would keep track of when you have fatigue throughout the day, so you can kind of self-monitor using something like a fatigue diary. It's important to prioritize or identify what your goals are. In addition, the supporters of this strategy of self-management would really recommend things like role-playing. So learning and teaching how you can ask for assistance and how you can ask people to help so that you can reduce barriers are all very important to improving fatigue. Another intervention that I think should not go unaddressed is just the idea of energy conservation. So, you know, based on the idea that we all have a certain amount of energy each day, you might picture a glass of water. You can drink this lots of different ways. You can gulp it all down in one fair swoop, or you can take little sips throughout the day, or you can maybe just drink during meals. In the same way, we can control our energy. So when you do activities that you could be sitting to do, maybe you make that choice. You sit while doing those activities. You did them before standing, but now you're choosing to sit. You can plan rest throughout your day. You can organize areas so you don't have to, for example, reach for high things in the kitchen because that's more energy consuming, or even just organizing your workspace so that your desk and your computer are at an optimal height so you're not straining. Other interventions that have less rigorous research, but I think because they have very little to lose by trying them, would be things like muscle relaxation techniques, meditation, breathing techniques. These are things you can learn from professionals like an occupational therapist or a psychologist or a physical therapist. But you can also learn some of these things online and try them at home.
Dr. Norbach, a moment ago, I pointed out that the majority of people living with MS experience fatigue, and many of them use different medications to try to manage that fatigue. You've been involved in some research specifically related to these medications. Can you share what your research showed?
Sure. As you mentioned, many patients with MS use medications for improving fatigue. It is despite the fact that the evidence, the research supporting the use of those medication was inconsistent or contradictory. So we recently completed a large randomized double-blind controlled trial, which is the gold standard of research for finding the effect of a medication in a specific condition. And unfortunately, what we saw was multiple medications that we commonly use for MS fatigue, including amantadine, modafinil or Provigil, and methylphenidate or Ritalin, they do reduce the MS-related fatigue, but this reduction is the same amount as the sugar pill or placebo. So basically, none of those medications did a better job in improving fatigue than when they were compared to the sugar pill or placebo. So this large randomized controlled trial tells us that, unfortunately, at this moment, medications probably do not have a good effect, good enough effect on MS fatigue for the majority of patients. it's possible that there is a small group of patients, or what you call a subgroup of patients, who may in fact respond better to these medications, but we have to find that subgroup through research. What I forgot to mention was not only those medications were not better than placebo in improving fatigue, their side effects or their adverse events were more frequent than placebo. And the adverse events were mostly related to nervous system and included sleep problems, anxiety. So if they don't do a better job compared to placebo and they cause more side effects, it would be hard to recommend their use.
It's sort of ironic that some of those side effects that you just mentioned actually can contribute to experiencing a higher level of fatigue.
That's absolutely correct. So as one part of the management of MS fatigue is making sure that there is no secondary causes of fatigue, or those secondary causes of fatigue are addressed already. And what we mean from secondary causes are conditions that are not directly related to MS or caused by MS, but they come with MS and they can affect fatigue. For example, many medications that we prescribe for addressing other MS symptoms, such as medications for spasticity, for bladder dysfunction, for nerve pain, or numbness and tingling, they all can affect the severity of fatigue. So one low-hanging fruit is making sure the patient is not on a medication that they do not need, or is on the minimum dose, so reduce their impact on fatigue. Or, as you mentioned, other conditions that come with MS, such as bladder dysfunction, can disrupt patient's sleep, and that disruption of sleep can in turn worsen patient's fatigue. So as part of comprehensive management of MS symptoms, it is important to recognize other contributors to MS fatigue, including medications and including comorbidities that come with MS, such as bladder dysfunction and sleep problems.
I'll pose this question to both of you. What do you see in the way of research that suggests that we might be looking at and talking about more robust ways of dealing with MS-related fatigue in the future? Dr. Zukowski?
Yeah, you know, I think, interestingly, the Society is funding a study right now that is looking at cognitive behavioral therapy in combination with modafinil, which is one medication that's often prescribed for someone who has fatigue. The idea is to look at, is it cognitive behavioral therapy alone that can make the biggest difference to fatigue, or is it the combination with modafinil that really makes the biggest difference to people suffering from fatigue? So I think these kinds of studies of combining medication with a behavioral therapy, I think are really a good direction to go. I think that medications have really serious side effects, but often they can make such a big difference. And the behavioral therapies require a lot of effort. And so if we can combine these two things, maybe we can come to a much more impactful or beneficial way of treating fatigue.
And Dr. Norbach, what are you seeing in the research arena?
So we have been hearing a lot about personalized medicine, precision medicine, and in the setting of MS symptoms, we are hoping to find some patient characteristic that change the response to specific treatment. For example, if we can find a biomarker or a baseline characteristic of a symptom, basically, that can affect the response of a patient to a specific treatment, that would be great. For example, during the same study of fatigue medications that we alluded to earlier, we noted that there is a possibility that patients who have both fatigue, meaning they have subjective lack of energy, and excessive daytime sleepiness, meaning that they have a tendency to fall asleep very easily during the day, in different circumstances. Those patients may respond better to weight-promoting agents such as modafinil and Ritalin. So in the next step, we are hoping to focus our research in that subgroup of patients, basically patients who have both fatigue and excessive daytime sleepiness, and try those medication in this subgroup to see if this subgroup of patients really benefit from medication, as opposed to overall population of patients with MS and fatigue. So finding biomarkers or finding baseline characteristics that alter response to treatment, which is basically the basis of precision medicine or individualized medicine, is our next goal for MS symptom management.
Fatigue is one of those MS symptoms that I call a stopper, because it can keep people from fully engaging in life, and that can set them down a path of isolation and even depression, which makes identifying ways to effectively manage MS-related fatigue really important work. And I can't thank both of you enough for the work you do to help people live their very best lives with MS. Dr. Bardia Norbach and Dr. Kathy Zukowski, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me, John.
Thank you for having me.
If you're a regular listener, then you know I'm always on the lookout for difference makers in the MS community. Well, in this case, this difference maker found me by submitting the winning bid in a fundraising auction for the MS Society. We're about to meet someone who's devoting her efforts and energies to ensure that the services are available that can make a real difference in the everyday challenges that confront people with MS. In a moment, we'll meet my special guest, Christina Antello. My special guest today is Christina Antello. Christina won this interview by submitting the winning bid in the online auction that was part of the National MS Society's Keep Moving Forward virtual fundraising event. MS has touched Christina's life since she was a child, and her experience motivated and inspired her to become a longtime supporter of the MS Society. I'm so happy to have her joining me. So thank you for submitting that winning bid, and welcome to the podcast, Christina.
Great. Thank you for having me so much.
I've always believed that a good place to start is right at the beginning. So can you tell us about how you became involved with the National MS Society?
Sure. My relationship with the MS Society has been a very long one. My mom was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 9. And at first, she just kind of had some of these very mild symptoms. But over time, they got more and more debilitating. And so when it finally came time where she couldn't work any longer and was more homebound, we got closer with our local MS chapter. And they actually were a godsend to us. They were able to put us in touch with so many resources that we needed over time. For example, like Meals on Wheels, once she got to the point where she was homebound and couldn't cook her own meals, they put us in touch and helped us with the application. And sure enough, my mom got 2 or 3 hot meals a day. Other things, kind of even signing her up for the application that would eventually get her some assistance with an electronic wheelchair, a little hover round she used to have that would be able to kind of turn on a dime and circle around and what have you. So really, they were such a godsend for us.
When we first spoke about getting together for this interview, you mentioned that you saw providing services to people living with MS was particularly important. And I think you just started to touch upon why that might be so. Can you talk a little bit about how you see services as potentially life-changing for so many people?
Sure. I mean, I know over the last few years, especially, the MS Society has really had a heavy emphasis and focus on finding a cure. And I'm certainly for that. I definitely want a cure. But I do feel like a lot of these pharmaceutical companies are incentivized to find that cure on their own because they will be able to, you know, hopefully make their money back in research and development, the cost that they've sunk in there by selling hopefully a blockbuster drug that is a cure. And so at the end of the day, what I think of the MS Society is the services component. And that is really the piece that is so, so important to me, was so important to my mom, because once you've been diagnosed, once you're living with it, and there's not a cure right now, and how do you struggle through? And having kind of those lifelines really becomes so important. I mean, MS is the kind of disease that, you know, you fall down out of your chair and you can't get back up and you're stuck on the floor. And, you know, not having the services that MS helped put us in touch with, like having a nurse come check on my mom every day, having the meals delivered to her house, having, you know, she got to the point where she couldn't swallow very well and she had to take those high energy protein drinks and Sure Plus, and they found a way to have those delivered to her by the caseload. Or even, you know, for the bedliners and things like that. I mean, having those things that you don't think about when you're first sick, but that you cannot survive without, and having somebody be able to help kind of put you in touch with those things to help you survive and really kind of at least try to thrive and enjoy, you know, the time that you have, even though you're dealing with a very, very difficult disease.
You know, I think you just mentioned so many of the reasons why I am personally such a fan of the MS Navigators program that the Society has, because the Navigators are a team of professionals who are trained in taking individual cases. It's one-on-one and getting you the solutions, the resources that you yourself most need. And I just think they do an incredible job. So when I hear someone like you talking about all of the things that the Society can provide, I always like to mention, here's all people have to do. If they go to the Society's website and they do a search on MS Navigators, they're going to find that real quick. And you can contact an MS Navigator by email or phone or even live chat right on the website. So it's pretty easy to access, and they provide the very kinds of things you just mentioned. I know that somewhere along the way, you made a cross-country move, relocating yourself from Texas to Washington, D.C. And I'm curious, what brought you to D.C.?
Well, I always fell in love with politics when I was in high school, and I always loved kind of the allure of Washington. So I actually came here to go to college. I left for a few years after my first job out of college, but I came back to go to law school, worked on Capitol Hill in the Senate, worked for then Senators Clinton and Daschle, and then a law firm, and now I'm a lobbyist here in town.
Obviously, you have a job that keeps you more than busy, especially this time of year. But I also know that you are heavily involved in helping to plan and support the Ambassador's Ball. Last year, it was my honor to speak at the Ambassador's Ball. And I have to say that without question, it was one of the highlights of 2019 for me. But I'm sure we have some listeners who aren't familiar with that event. So can you tell us what the Ambassador's Ball is all about?
Sure. Actually, I've been working with the Ambassador's Ball, I think, for over a dozen years, maybe upwards of 15 now. But several years ago, decades ago, there came a time of austerity where the federal government decided that they wouldn't be able to hold big fancy parties for the ambassadors that were coming from the other countries to the United States after they were received by the president. There used to be a big fancy gala. And for the sake of saving money, they cut that. And so the MS Society picked it up and said, we will now use this as our fundraising mechanism. And we started throwing the Ambassador's Ball and invited all of these various countries to participate and wear their local garb, their festive garb, and use it as a fundraising tool here in town. I've been involved again for about 15 years or so. And it really kind of brings together, you know, the members of Congress, folks in the administration, whatever the presidential administration, it really kind of spans bipartisan efforts. House of Congress versus the Senate, again, into the administration. Ambassadors from all over the world come. And then you get kind of a who's who in Washington elite as well, kind of participate. And it's really been a great time for me. I do it personally, socially. I love the prospects of it, but it's also an amazing opportunity kind of professionally to kind of know all of these people, especially now. I've taken all of this experience and started my own firm. And so being able to kind of have my company be in the middle of it is really amazing too. And so Ferox Strategies has been a sponsor since I started it 3 years ago.
This year, not too long ago, as a matter of fact, the Ambassador's Ball became a virtual event for very obvious reasons. I attended this year, and I'm looking forward to attending in person when we can meet face-to-face again. And being an attendee at the Ambassador's Ball, it was just a remarkable, remarkable evening. So thank you personally for all the work you do to make that happen.
No, absolutely. I got to attend this year virtually as well. I was super excited because in the auction, I won dinner with the Italian ambassador. So I'm very excited for that. But also our honoree this year was the baseball player, Zimmerman, and his mom has multiple sclerosis, just like my mom did. And I kind of had always loved that about him, that he took this personal time, even though he's a big famous ball player, to give back. And he works through the Zim Foundation, this opportunity to give children whose parents are afflicted with MS this opportunity to go to the ballpark, to feel like a kid and not be worried about MS and get free hot dogs and all that kind of stuff. And I went to one of his games when I first had my first daughter, and she was about 6 months old. He was signing baseball for all the kids, and I didn't have a baseball. I'm like, hey, will you sign my baby? And he signed my baby, and I had a picture of it. So as he was being honored, I got to talk to him after the party was over, and my daughter, who's now 9, got to show him the picture and be like, here I am, you signed me back then. And it's really kind of a great kind of full circle moment for me and all of the work that I've done with the MS Society here in D.C., for over a decade to kind of see him be honored in this way and really recognize his work with the Zim Foundation for these kids.
Well, just in case we have some people who are not baseball fans, I just want to add that Ryan Zimmerman is considered one of the finest, if not the finest, baseball player playing today. He is a multiple award winner, both personally and, of course, as part of a World Series winning team. So he has done an awful lot for the game. And yet, when Major League Baseball announced that they were playing this year, Ryan said, I'd love to play. I'd love to be with my teammates. But my mom has MS, and I'm a little worried that if I were to be exposed to COVID-19, I might be fine, but I could be a carrier, and I'm not willing to risk my mom's health. So he decided to sit out the season, and really doing that bring worldwide attention to the fact that we have a very vulnerable population out there of people who are older, people with comorbidities, people who really need support and certainly acknowledgement so that we know who we have to take care of. And he took care of his mom. I thought that was just a magnificent gesture.
Me too. I thought it was amazing. I think he is hoping to come back next year. So once we hopefully have a vaccine and are able to treat it. But I did think that was amazing as well. And it really goes to show you kind of the heart that he has, that he would be willing to make those sacrifices, obviously.
So you won this interview in a fundraising auction. Sounds like you won what's going to be a fabulous dinner with the Italian ambassador at a fundraising auction. What's important to you about supporting the National MS Society, especially this year?
Gosh, I have, even after working on the ball for all these years, I joined the board of the MS Society, and I really fought hard over the years to really kind of keep focus again on those services. I understand the call for the cure. I definitely want a cure. But I really felt it was so important to also keep that heavy emphasis on services. And especially now, I mean, more and more folks are, have fewer and fewer resources, and really having the ability to pitch in and help them if they need it, because they don't have alternatives. They don't have other options. And, it's always been so important and so key to me to have that. I always remember my mom when I do it. I feel like it's the one thing in my life that I can point to and be like, here, mom, I'm doing this for you. I promised not to her personally, but after she passed away, I promised myself, I was like, I would find ways to keep doing things kind of in her honor that would benefit her, to pay back all of the things that folks had done for us. And that's why I hope I'm still making a difference. I connect a lot of my clients to it and make sure that they all give, and helpful to keeping the coffers full there, at least here in the DC region and also with the national chapter. But really, really love working with them.
Christina Antello, thank you for all the ways you keep finding to honor your mom through your efforts to help improve the lives of so many people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/166. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think that I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. With vital funding from supporters like you, the National MS Society is continuing to meet the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times, while ensuring that the MS research community rebounds quickly from COVID-19, so that the progress and momentum toward finding a cure continues. And that's why I hope that, as you're able, you'll make a donation to the Society's COVID-19 Response Fund. It couldn't be easier. Just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. I hope you'll consider contributing today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.